Good morning. My name is Matt McKenna. I'm the director of the Great Lakes Washington Program at the Northeast Midwest Institute. Thank you very much for attending today's briefing. I think it should be a very important session. First off, I would like to say how happy we are at the Northeast Midwest Institute to partner with Environmental Law and Policy Center to host today's briefing and some of the great work that they've done on climate change and just kind of giving a full assessment of the science in the region and what we currently know of the impacts of climate change in the Great Lakes. I'd also like to quickly thank Senator Debbie Stabenow's office for helping us secure this room. Senator Stabenow is the co-chair of the bipartisan Great Lakes Task Force. And I'd also like to thank Senator Tammy Duckworth's office. They also helped find space for today's briefing. On the House side, Congresswoman Dingell's office also was very helpful in trying to make this event happen today. Second off, I really wanted to stress if you work for Great Lakes office that you should really encourage your boss, if they aren't currently a member of the Great Lakes Task Force, to join. I'm very happy to assist any offices in doing that. So if you want to reach out to me, my email is mmckenna, that's mmckenna, at nemw.org. And finally, I'd like to introduce Howard Lerner, who is the President and Executive Director of the Environmental Law and Policy Center, which is the Midwest's premier environmental legal advocacy and eco-business innovation organization. Howard?
Thank you, Matt. Before I became an attorney, I was a community organizer. Love packed rooms. Okay. Welcome. I'm Howard Lerner. I'm the Executive Director of the Environmental Law and Policy Center. Thank you to Senator Stabenow and Duckworth for helping to organize and facilitate this briefing. And thank you to our good partners, Mike and Matthew, at the Northeast Midwest Institute for bringing it together. We're here to brief you on a report that was recently commissioned by the Environmental Law and Policy Center, some of the leading Big Ten, Midwest University, and Canadian University scientists of the impact of climate change on the Great Lakes. A little bit about the Great Lakes, and most of you know this, the Great Lakes is where we live, where we work, it's where we play. When you talk to people about the Great Lakes around the Midwest, and we've hired Ann Selzer to do a lot of focus groups and polling for us. Some of you may have come across Ann. She does the Iowa poll for the Des Moines Register and USA Today. She's absolutely terrific. And here's what we learn when we meet with people, and we're dealing here mostly with moderate swing independent voters. When it comes to the Great Lakes and safe, clean drinking water, it's a 90-10 issue. And it doesn't matter political affiliation. It doesn't matter race, gender, or economics. When it comes to protecting the Great Lakes and safe, clean drinking water, uniform support. And when we've begun to look at how do people see climate change problems through the lens of the Great Lakes and safe, clean drinking water, it triggers a lot of interest. And it triggers a lot of interest and concern amongst people, again, both sides of the political spectrum. Doesn't matter in terms of race, gender, economics, geography. Because the Great Lakes is almost an organizing principle. It's where all of us in the Midwest who are anywhere near Lake Michigan, Lake Erie, Lake Ontario, Lake Superior, it's our home. Lake Huron, left one out. So when it comes to the Great Lakes, people want to hear the science. They want to really understand what's real, what's not. And what we've learned is top-rate university scientists at the Big Ten. And I know Maryland and Rutgers are now in the Big Ten. It's not the Big Ten, okay? But those Michigan, Illinois, Michigan State, Ohio State scientists are very trusted. Because they do solid work that people know, people went to the schools, or their family members went to their schools, or their neighbors went to the schools, as places where we trust people in the Midwest. So what we've done is we've commissioned a state of the science report on the impacts of climate change on the Great Lakes following the National Climate Assessment. A team led by Professor Don Wubbles and including Professor Dana Infante and Professor Ashish have put together a report that really says, here's what's happening, here's what's going on, here's the best knowledge we have of what's happening. And you're going to hear a lot from the three of them, and I'll tell you about their backgrounds in just a second. We also realize that people don't want to just hear about problems. People want to hear about solutions. So whenever the Environmental Law and Policy Center does something like this, what we do is we say, here are the problems, and here are actions that people can take to help solve the problems. So combined with the state of the science assessment of the impact of climate change on the Great Lakes is a parallel piece on recommended policy solutions, what can we do? And with regard to the climate change solutions in the Great Lakes, and I'll talk a little bit about it later, the punchline is there are multiple benefits. Almost everything that would be done to help solve climate change problems also helps solve other pollution problems, improves public health, creates jobs, helps the regional economy. So let me introduce, if I can, the three scientists who you'll hear from. Professor Don Wubbles, who's the lead author, is a scientist at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. He's been a coordinating lead author of the Science Assessment Report of the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and he was a member of the team leading the 2014 U.S. National Climate Assessment. Don will give an overview of the report and discuss some of the physical changes to the lake. He'll be followed by Professor Ashish Sharma, who's Illinois' research climatologist at the Illinois State Water Survey and the Prairie Research Institute at the University of Illinois. And Ashish will discuss the changes in watershed hydrology and agricultural and urban impacts. In the third, batter at the plate, Professor Dana Infante is in the Department of Fisheries and Wildlife at Michigan State University, and Dana will highlight the ecological changes as well as the public health and ecological impacts of changes on the Great Lakes. So I think you're going to get some very interesting science from the three professors. We'll talk just a little bit about policy solutions, and we'd be pleased to address any questions, suggestions you have. Thank you for joining us this morning, and thank you again to Northeast Midwest for coordinating with us. Don Wubbles.
Thanks, Howard. So when Howard first asked me to lead a special assessment of the impacts of climate change in the Great Lakes, I had just completed leading the first volume of the fourth National Climate Assessment for the U.S. government. It came out in November of 2017, and then the second volume was published this last year, actually on Black Friday. So I agreed to do this, and I immediately began looking for top leaders in major universities and national labs, particularly in states and regions connected to the Great Lakes themselves. As a result, we have 18 top experts in the earth and natural sciences, in engineering, the social sciences, economics, that have prepared this assessment. Most of these are from six states bordering the Great Lakes, plus three experts from Canada. Our goal for the assessment was to analyze the peer-reviewed literature and to assess the state of the art regarding the knowledge about the current and projected impacts of climate change on the Great Lakes. This assessment was aimed at evaluating the effects of climate change on the Great Lakes and the regions around the lakes, particularly in the United States. So what do those findings tell us? First, climate change is already affecting both the climate of the Great Lakes region and the physical behavior of the Great Lakes themselves. Over the last two centuries, the Great Lakes have been significantly impacted by human activities, and climate change is now adding more challenges and another layer of stress. This report points a stark picture of changes in store for the lakes as a result of our changing climate. We'll start by looking at the climate changes in the region, and kind of ahead of myself here on the slide, so let me go back a little bit. The temperature of the United States, well, the temperature globally has changed about 1.8 degrees Fahrenheit, 1 degree centigrade, over the last century plus, over the last 120 years. The similar change is found for the United States as a whole, about 1.8 degrees. And a very similar change is found for the Great Lakes region. If we just looked at the Great Lakes region by itself relative to a period that we chose for the U.S. National Climate Assessment, 1901 to 1960, then we would see the last 30 years have changed about 1.4 degrees. So most of the changes we've seen in temperature have appeared over the last 30, 40 years, last 50 years. This is one of the reasons that we're so concerned about climate change. In fact, these changes are much more rapid than nature tends to change the Earth's climate system, about 10 times more rapid. And so that makes it very difficult for both human systems and ecosystems to adapt to those changes. That's one of the reasons overall why we're so concerned about the changes in climate that are occurring. Now, if we look at the projections for the future, it really depends on which pathway we follow in terms of the continued use of fossil fuels and land use change that are driving these changes in climate we've been seeing. And that could follow several different pathways. In this assessment, we looked at a high scenario, which kind of matches the path we're on right now. If you looked at the emissions through 2018, we're right on the high scenario. And these are scenarios that were developed over 10 years ago. And that's the one in red there in the bottom left. And then the other scenario we looked at was the low scenario, which corresponds to the blue scenario, where emissions by mid-century are expected to peak, and then we have to transition heavily away from the use of fossil fuels towards reducing the emissions. With the high scenario, we find in the Great Lakes region a 9.8 degree Fahrenheit increase, with the largest increases being to the northern states of the region. The low scenario, 5.7 degrees. Now, to get an idea of what all these different temperatures mean, the last ice age, when we had hundreds of feet of ice over the Great Lakes region, was about 15 degrees Fahrenheit colder than now. So when we start talking about even 1.8 degrees, we're talking about something that's quite large as a warming relative to that past. And as a result, we're seeing lots of other impacts that I'll talk about in a minute. But by the end of the century, we could be seeing something a whole lot larger. Precipitation in the Great Lakes has also been changing. We've seen about a 10% increase in the amount of precipitation overall in the Great Lakes region, much of that precipitation happening in winter and spring. The spring was a strong indicator of kind of what we're seeing. And more of that precipitation happening is larger events, ever larger events. I've done a number of studies showing over the last five decades we've had an ever increasing by decade increase in the amount of precipitation coming as larger, unusual, what previously were unusual events. Over this century, we can expect another 10% increase overall in the Great Lakes region. Again, most of that coming in winter and spring, and summers tending to be somewhat drier than in the past. And an increasing trend for this precipitation coming as larger events is expected to continue. For example, as much as 19% more precipitation for a five-year return event, that's called a one-in-five-year event, by the end of the century, by 2070 to 2099. Also, extremes are changing. So it's not just about temperature changes itself, the average temperature, it's about extremes that really matters to the region. The days with maximum temperature greater than 90 degrees are likely to increase substantially over this century under both the low and high scenarios. With the high scenarios, we could see 2 months more days of above 90 degrees. Meanwhile, what sometimes is thought as being a good thing is the number of days below freezing are likely to decrease significantly, 45 to 55 days for the high scenario under the by the end of the century, and 25 to 35 days under the low scenario. However, that also means less cold days for major fruit trees like cherries, which are really important in both Wisconsin and Michigan. So not everything is so good about that. Snowfall in the region is likely overall to decrease, especially under the high scenario, 30 to 60% by the end of the century. But lake effect snows actually may increase when you have the right situation for a large snowfall. Lake effect snows actually could increase, which are going to affect Michigan, Indiana, New York, and other places. So I'm going to turn it over to Ashish, who will talk about the Great Lakes themselves.
Thank you, Don. So let's look at the Great Lakes themselves. Okay, so during the summers, summer water temperature has increased over the last six decades, and it is projected to increase substantially over the century. So if you look at the map here, the greatest rate of increase is happening in the deeper waters, and less increase over the shorelines. So, and this is alarming because water has high heat capacity, and it absorbs that heat and it releases very slowly. Also, we see water levels have fluctuated considerably over multi-decadal scales and will continue to do so. So, and this is important for shipping industry and shorelines. If you look at the changes in Great Lakes ice cover during winters, the maximum ice cover has generally decreased over the last 40 years or four decades. Okay, and we expect that trend to continue. Likewise, the duration, so the ice cover is decreasing as well as the duration throughout the year is also decreasing over the last four decades. And still here, we expect the trend to decline. And this is, if you look at the previous slide, the temperatures, I said heat capacity is high, and I think that's one of the primary reasons we see low ice cover and the duration as well very low. When we look at the changes in Great Lakes watershed hydrology, we are seeing that increase in precipitation will increase flooding in the region. Okay, during the summers, high summer and fall temperatures will increase evaporation going back into the atmosphere during the growing season. It will make more complications when during the summers the precipitation will be increasingly variable and lower in comparison to spring and winters, and the river flows during the summers will likely be low, okay, by the end of the century. And you can see these figures, how it's going to impact, how it has impacted, especially in Michigan, these kind of flash floods that happen in spring. Looking at agriculture, which is a very important sector for Great Lakes and Midwest, changes in seasonal precipitation are affecting farmers, and this has happened this year itself, that we are having planting delays caused by spring flooding and excessive wet soil conditions. Likewise, if we go further in the season, during the summer and fall, hotter and drier conditions later in the growing season increase the demand for irrigation because there would be a lot of evaporation happening, and then we'll have to suck up the groundwater as well. And that is to mitigate the crop loss. Overall, climate change will likely reduce crop yields for both soybean and maize by 10 to 30% by mid-century, especially in the southern part of the Great Lakes region. And this is alarming because that's the Midwest and Great Lakes is a major agricultural belt for the region. As well, looking at urban, this area hosts a lot of metropolitan areas, so urban areas are important. Okay, in the summer, high temperatures and heat waves cause poor air quality. Okay, and that harm public health, especially the most vulnerable people, elderly and children, having health issues and asthma. Projected increase in extreme precipitation will likely exacerbate flooding, okay, especially in winter, spring, and during summer thunderstorms. And we had an example of this yesterday here in DC as well. We have these flash floods that kind of disrupt the whole infrastructure and life. Overall, climate change will likely threaten drinking water quality and place greater stress on water infrastructure because when you have a lot of flash floods, for example, it combines with the sewage outflow and then it becomes a drinking water issue and the quality goes down. Likewise, when you have no water or heat wave events, you have less, you have like drought conditions as well. So then also water quantity and quality becomes an issue. Okay, so I'll now give it to Dana. She'll now talk about impacts on lake ecology, on the public, and the economy.
Thank you so much for the chance to be here. How's my volume?
Okay.
Very good. So, multiple studies have already shown us that the ecology of the Great Lakes is being affected by climate change, and we do unfortunately expect these changes to continue. To provide some context for the scale of changes that could occur, it's worth keeping in mind that climate has historically been the most single most important factor controlling distributions of the world's species. And with the warming air temperatures and changing precipitation patterns that we just learned about, scientists are documenting range changes of some popular sport fish and bait fish. Additionally, we're seeing shifts in ranges of mammals, with species becoming less common in parts of the region that they historically inhabited as these areas warm. And some examples of these animals include the moose, the northern flying squirrel, and the least chipmunk. Climate change may also be making parts of the region more favorable for invasive species. One example is the sea lamprey, a parasitic fish that preys on commercially and recreationally important Great Lakes fishes. Because of warming waters, lamprey in Lake Superior are growing larger and producing more offspring than they did historically. And currently, we invest millions of dollars to keep numbers of this fish at manageable levels. That cost will increase with more lamprey in the lakes. An additional ecological problem to expect could be more common and larger algae blooms in the Great Lakes. Warmer waters, more nutrient loading from intense rainfalls, and prolonged lake stratification, which means longer periods of time when the lake waters don't mix. These factors are all expected to increase in frequency with changing climate. Warming waters are also changing the types of algae comprising blooms. Blue-green algae that produce a toxin called microcystis are more common than they were historically, and this is the toxin that contaminated the city of Toledo's drinking water supply in 2014. With more frequent and severe algae blooms, costs to treat drinking water will increase. Besides these increased costs, costs of managing wastewater and stormwater discharged into the lakes may also increase. Combined sewer systems designed to treat waters are more likely to be overwhelmed during intense rainfalls, leading to untreated wastewater discharge directly into lakes and rivers. One problem when this occurs is that pathogens can also be discharged with the wastewater, making the receiving waters unsuitable for human uses due to the presence of E. coli bacteria and other diseases. Climate change will affect our roads. Extreme heat events contribute to asphalt buckling, and intense rainfalls can affect bridges and culverts because of channel erosion or inundation during flooding. Higher air temperatures during the growing season may require more water for irrigation, potentially leading to more consumptive water use in the region, an outcome that's expected to become more severe after mid-century. If Great Lakes levels drop, which could occur with increasing air temperature, the ability of ships to safely navigate shallow portions of the Great Lakes will be reduced, although with warming air temperatures, we may actually have a longer shipping season in general. While all of the residents and visitors to the Great Lakes region have the potential to be affected by changing climate, it's also worth noting that the many indigenous people and tribes of the Great Lakes may be uniquely and disproportionately affected due to the changes in landscapes, waters, foods, and other plants and animals that are culturally and economically important. So this information was a fairly quick overview of the ecological, public, and economic impacts that we can expect with changing climate. I'll be glad to answer more questions later. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Howard. Thank you.
Thank you, Dana.
And I'll be quick. This is real. This is what the sound science says. This is what's happening. As I said earlier, when we see that there are problems, we try to step up with solutions. So combined with the science report, and you can get this online at elpc.org/GL, as in Great Lakes, climate change. There's the full science report, an executive summary, and then the policy solutions paper that goes with it. elpc.org/GL climate change. And when we talk about solutions, the key on this is all of the solutions we describe have multiple benefits. They're good for reducing carbon pollution, for example, accelerating renewable energy, solar plus storage, and wind power. Creates jobs, it spurs economic growth in both rural and urban areas. We've shown how the supply chain grows, for example, in Illinois. 450 businesses engage in solar energy, wind energy, and geothermal energy, and more than 10,000 jobs. So good for reducing carbon pollution, good for creating jobs, good for economic growth. A second solution, far more aggressive on energy efficiency than we are today. Energy efficiency is the best, the fastest, the cheapest climate change solution. By improving energy efficiency, both through modern equipment and technologies and good approaches, we save residential and business consumers money on their utility bills, we create jobs, we reduce carbon and other pollution, we avoid it, and what we do is we keep dollars in the regional economy. Most of the Midwest states don't produce uranium or much natural gas. Some produce coal, some don't. But a large part of utility bills is for the fuel costs themselves. So for example, in Wisconsin, which doesn't produce either uranium, natural gas, or coal, energy efficiency keeps hundreds of millions of dollars in the state's economy rather than being exported and flowing out to states that do produce a lot of natural gas, mine uranium, mine coal. A third set of solutions involves public transit, investing in clean energy, clean electric vehicles, and making a Midwest higher speed rail network work. Better inner city rail pulls together the regional economy, avoids pollution, and helps create jobs through building that infrastructure. Fourth, and Dana touched upon this, the impact of climate change on what we're seeing of hazardous algae blooms. Some call them toxic algae blooms, harmful algae blooms, toxic algae outbreaks, the problems in western Lake Erie, increasingly in Green Bay, Wisconsin, emerging in Lake Superior. The warmer temperatures in the summer exacerbate the process to the extent that we reduce phosphorus pollution from manure and fertilizer runoff going in, for example, through the Maumee River Basin into western Lake Erie. We improve public health, safe drinking water supplies, we protect fisheries, and we spur enjoyable outdoor recreation where people can fish and boat and not go through slimy green stuff. Finally, we're looking about investing in the Great Lakes infrastructure. Congress has, as you know now, three times rejected President Trump's budget to cut back the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative funding. And about a month or so ago, President Trump reversed his position and in Grand Rapids, Michigan, said that he was stepping up to support $300 million for the Great Lakes. And that's good. As I started off saying before, the Great Lakes is where we live, it's where we work, it's where we play. When you talk about the Great Lakes, this is something that both can and should cut across party lines, racial lines, gender lines, urban versus rural. We want to make the Great Lakes better. Protecting the Great Lakes is an important way of dealing with climate change solutions in the Midwest. Thank you for joining us, and The three professors and I would be pleased to address questions you might have, and we welcome your suggestions as well. Thank you. Yes, sir.
So you obviously just mentioned a lot of very important solutions to fixing these issues. And I know you mentioned the 2014 drinking water crisis in Toledo. So I was wondering, looking at Toledo and how they recently passed the Lake Erie Bill of Rights, giving like legal standing to the lake itself, I was curious what your opinion on sort of local decisions as it pertains to the law. Like, I'm curious, do you think that's an anomaly, or as you mentioned, you know, these issues are 90-10, they're bipartisan, everyone there in the region wants the support. Do you think we'll see more sort of, you know, bills of rights like that, and what impact do you think that will have on the actual ecology and health of the
I think most of you heard it was a question about the Lake Erie Bill of Rights that was passed in Toledo, where the algae bloom problems have been severe almost every summer, particularly in 2014. For those of you who don't know, that summer it was not safe for people to drink water from the lake for 72 hours. Half a million people in the Toledo area had to have fresh water bussed in by the National Guard. And that lasted for 3 days. That's not acceptable for all the obvious reasons. Full disclosure, I'm one of the co-lead counsels of the litigation before the Northern District of Ohio, the Federal District Court, in which the judge has reversed the U.S. EPA's failure to act and the Ohio EPA's failure to act to reduce phosphorus pollution from manure and fertilizer that's led to and is causing toxic algae blooms in western Lake Erie. That litigation is going forward, and we're very closely aligned with the City of Toledo and with Lucas County, the surrounding county who joined the lawsuit, I'd say virtually, if not entirely, 100% on our side. The Lake Erie Bill of Rights reflects the frustration of people in that city, and I think you're going to see more of this happening, that it's not safe to drink the local water supply. The algae blooms in that area are present and obvious. There are E. coli problems in southwest Wisconsin and northeast Wisconsin. And I think you will indeed see much more local action if our Clean Water Act implementation and enforcement system that's done by both the federal government and the state environmental agencies doesn't snap up pretty quickly and begin dealing with real life problems that affect fisheries, affect people's safe drinking water supply, affect the local economy. Those of you who aren't from the area may or may not know Sandusky, Ohio, which now has very bad algae bloom problems, is the home of both Cedar Point, the amusement park. Anybody go to Cedar Point? All right. Cedar Point, highest roller coasters in the country. Every 18 to 25-year-old kid who isn't interning on Capitol Hill works there in the summer. It's a wonderful place. It doesn't work very well if the drinking water supply isn't safe, and the economy locally is driven in the summer by Cedar Point. The other big sort of local industry, in addition to fisheries, is charter boats. Lots of people take boats, and taking charter boats through algae-laden, scummy green water is not terribly attractive, and it's hurting the local economy. So we're going to see more local action if the Clean Water Act regulatory system is not applied effectively to create change pretty quickly. I'll tell you what, we'll just go this way, and I sort of won't. Okay, and then here. Yes, ma'am.
So on the Gulf and Atlantic coast, the ecosystem restoration and nature-based solutions to climate adaptation are being used as a buffer against storms and flooding. Is there a similar work in green infrastructure going on in the Great Lakes? If you can name any programs or anything.
Dan, do you want to handle that one?
I think that the Sea Grant program working in the region has taken some steps in that direction, but I'm not fully familiar with all the actions they might have taken. But they would be a place to begin.
I, th-
I think we do mention something about that in the report itself, so you might want to look there.
Yeah, the short of it is the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. If you look at GLRI, we'll give you the parallel you're looking for. Yes, sir.
I just live in Ann Arbor, but I live in San Diego, California.
Go Blue West.
I know, right? But one question I had is, because the Great Lakes region is such a large region, if the Great Lakes warm, are there any clear ideas of the specific impacts it'll have on a national weather level? So, I mean, in terms of affecting the jet stream, affecting larger weather patterns, could California, could the rest of the U.S. see changes if the Great Lakes changes like this?
Certainly. We did not look too much at the effects on future weather patterns because there just isn't enough known yet in terms of the warming. The warming is occurring, so that's clear in what's happening to the lakes. But getting a signal for that effect versus the overall large signal that's occurring because of changes occurring around the world, particularly in the Arctic. So the Arctic changes are particularly driving the jet stream moving further north, making it weightier, leading to a lot of the issues, both for cold and hot, that we've had in recent years. We just had 90-degree weather in Anchorage the last few days, and that's in part related to the weightiness in the jet stream. There definitely are factors there, but right now it's kind of playing second fiddle to what's going on in the Arctic. Right. Do you want to add to this?
Yeah. Just to add to that, if the Great Lakes warm, so you can imagine the most of the winds work on the principle of changes in pressure gradient. Mm-hmm. So the changes in pressure gradient with respect to Arctic and the Great Lakes and the Gulf, for example, and the Great Lakes, that will change, and you will see a lot of changes, not only over the Great Lakes, but also from the Gulf Coast towards the northeast as well as towards the Arctic. There will be changes.
Quick observation for you. As I mentioned earlier, we did a series of focus groups on a regular basis around the region. Any of you from the Chicago area? Tom Skilling means something to you? Tom Skilling, longtime meteorologist, weatherman on WGN-TV, the world's greatest network. When we tested credibility of various people in some areas in the Chicago suburb, number one, Tom Skilling. People love him and trust him. And there's something there about local weather people, meteorologists, a lot of credibility when they talk about climate issues. There was a question here. Yes, sir.
I had a question. I heard both that there would be an increase in precipitation and also potentially a decrease in lake levels.
Certainly. So overall, as we look over the coming decades, we expect an increase in precipitation in the winter and spring, even more than we've had in recent decades, and more of that coming as larger events, and then tending to be drier summers. So warmer temperatures overall likely to lead more evaporation. So even though in the winters and springs, we're going to probably have an increased amount of water going into the Great Lakes, the changes in evaporation are also important, and probably also less ice in the winter in the lakes. That's also going to increase evaporation. So how that balance plays out is what's still not so clear. So the Great Lakes have fluctuated a whole lot over many decades, and right now are kind of an extreme high. We expect that those fluctuations to continue because it's going to depend on the year-to-year winter weather as to how those driving forces balance out. You know, are we going to have more evaporation relative to the increase in precipitation? So that's the issue. Some of the analyses that have been done have suggested that there could be slight decreases overall in the Great Lakes, and other analyses have said that may not be true. So we're And the jury's still out on that.
Quick comment on hydrology of the Great Lakes. For those of you who might not know, the Great Lakes are actually not flat. They're tipped. Water flows from Lake Superior through the Sioux over at the Straits of Mackinac, where it splits to the Lake Michigan, the Lake Huron side, and then over to Erie and Ontario. So if you have relatively warmer winters and less ice formation up in northern Minnesota in Lake Superior, then you're going to have more water overall flowing through the system and working its way down. There's a question here. Yes, sir. And then behind you. Okay.
Given that the Great Lakes being affected by climate change isn't strictly a U.S. problem, much of the Great Lakes border Canada, I just wanted to know if there are any policies or perhaps studies that are being conducted jointly together.
Yeah. A couple things just to mention. First of all, this scientific study was done on a binational basis. Canadian scientists with the United States scientists, for exactly the reason you're suggesting. Secondly, the IJC, the International Joint Commission, three commissioners from Canada, three from the United States, very influential on Great Lakes policy. Third, the Great Lakes Water Quality Agreement, dealing with Western Lake Erie, that's Ontario, Michigan, Indiana, and Ohio, to reduce the amount of phosphorus by 40% by 2025. There are more examples, but those are three quick ones of binational cooperation. Obvious point, the two nations need to work together on a common water body.
Yeah, just to add to this, we did emphasize the United States side in this assessment, but I gave a talk to last month to the Great Lakes mayors, which represent both countries, and there was strong interest, and then maybe we need to do another special assessment that expands upon what we did here and make sure it's kind of equally divided between the analyses for Canada and the United States. And we would like to do that, but that hasn't happened yet.
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, yeah, so thanks for speaking. And when you were going through the solutions list, I might encourage one addition to that.
Sure.
Which is to, for environmentalists and scientists in the Great Lakes region and broadly, to deeply work for increased indigenous sovereignty in the region. There's lots of coalitions across the Great Lakes tribes. You know, there's 14 recognized in Michigan, many more recognized in Wisconsin. We've got the indigenous peoples of Canada. Anyway, they've got, you may or may not be aware, they have, you know, great plans, climate change vision, things they're doing. Somebody mentioned green infrastructure restoration. There's huge wildlife restoration going on in the Northern Lakes. So I might, and given that all of these things are sort of, all of these bad things are externalities of colonialism, I might, you know, encourage you to add supporting indigenous sovereignty in the Great Lakes to the list of solutions.
In a word, yes, we work very closely with tribal governments. Tribal nations actually have an entire set of Clean Water Act responsibilities and authorities that extend beyond the U.S. EPA. The tribal members of our staff agree with you.
We do have discussion in the assessment about the impacts on the Native communities and the significance of that. Perhaps not enough, but we're trying to keep the report as small as possible. But we recognize that that's extremely important.
And it's a little bit different framing from saying these people are affected as an effect versus centering them.
Certainly.
In candor, we are probably, you know, we tend at the Environmental Law and Policy Center to work very closely with some of the tribes, but we're also very careful we don't speak for the tribes. And that's, you know, so when you're talking about the perspective you frame a report from, we're not the right people to frame a report from the perspective of the tribes. Tribal nations are very well positioned to speak effectively for themselves, so we do a fair amount of stuff together. Yes, ma'am?
is the 40% phosphorus reduction you talked about from like non-point source pollution or point source pollution or a combination of both?
It's a combination of both, but here's the factual reality. According to the Ohio EPA, 88% of the phosphorus that goes from the Maumee River Basin is into Western Lake Erie comes from agricultural sources. So if you're going to reduce by 40% by 2025 and you do the math, simply put, most of it has to come from agriculture. In different parts of Lake Erie, the allocation may be somewhat different, but it's heavily agricultural. So if you're not dealing with agriculture, you're not going to get to 40%.
Do you guys have any sort of solutions for that, or have you proposed anything to address agricultural pollution without impeding on farmers' livelihoods?
First of all, much of the source of phosphorus pollution, I'll talk here about the Maumee River watershed that we've done a lot of data analysis on, is not coming from what you would call farmers. The increasingly the largest growing source is coming from CAFOs, large animal feedlot operations, and an operation with 100,000 chickens or 60,000 pigs is not what I would call a farmer. Okay, so in terms of affecting farmers' livelihoods, when you're dealing with manure runoff pollution from CAFOs, you're dealing with a agricultural business operation or an animal business operation, not a farmer. I just don't think you call 100,000 chickens in sheds farmers. Okay, manure is growing extraordinarily rapidly. It's the single largest source of phosphorus these days, getting into Western Lake Erie. So clearly you need to reduce the amount of manure that gets in, and that's dealing with CAFOs in addition to fertilizer runoff from corn and soy, where there's been some progress.
There's a question.
As bad as things sound for the Great Lakes with climate change, I think they sound a lot worse for, say, Florida or the Southwest. And that makes me wonder if perhaps if the region deals with these infrastructure issues you talked about, these policy issues you talked about, whether you might actually see some climate migration to the region and whether there's actually economic opportunity out of this as well. Any thoughts on that?
The biggest economic opportunity in the Great Lakes area is simply the availability of fresh water. You know, the Pentagon for years used to do its crisis modeling based on wars grounded on religious differences. The Pentagon now does the modeling based on the absence of water. The Great Lakes is the largest freshwater supply in the world, roughly 21% of the freshwater. That is a huge asset to the Great Lakes regional economy if we can do the vital steps to keep the water safe and clean. You know, the question about algae blooms in Western Lake Erie, of course, goes in the opposite direction. To the extent that there are parts of the country in which the population is growing beyond the ability of local water resources to sustain that population, even taking into account much more efficient water uses, indeed there may be some migration back to the Midwest and the Great Lakes, because the availability of water is a huge economic asset and a huge livability asset for the region.
I've long said that the migration away from the Midwest is going to change over the coming decades because of the difficulties that are likely to happen in the Southeast and Southwest with not only sea level rise, but just the warming temperatures and making conditions much more livable. But I think the other big concern here is other parts of the country blending the water from the Great Lakes, and that's going to be an interesting battle over the coming years.
Just to add to, to this point, Great Lakes are so huge that the 10 connections of Great Lakes with surrounding area, being in Arctic or the Gulf or the area, that will have huge impact not only over the Great Lakes but other places. So the migration would depend on how we treat Great Lakes those.
I should probably just add, before we get to the gentleman's question, as our colleagues at the Northeast Midwest Institute know, there's been a lot of work over, say, the past 20 years to limit the diversion of water out of the Great Lakes. Simply put, because of various state actions and federal actions, any large-scale diversion of fresh water from the Great Lakes to other regions of the country would be extraordinarily difficult to do. Yes, sir.
Returning to your point on Great Lakes hydrology,
sure.
If you have record high levels in Lake Superior, how long does it take approximately for that record high water to make it down to, say, Lake Ontario?
You'll have to talk to an obscure agency. I believe the name is the Lake Superior Water Board or something close
to that. I've been reading, there's a very good book about the Great Lakes called The Death and Might of the Great Lakes.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, it's mostly about the death because it's all about all the invasive species and so forth.
Danny Gibbs' book.
Yeah, Danny Gibbs. And I think in that he says 14 months to make that transfer.
The quick piece is people know where the Sioux is, the Sioux Locks, near Sioux Saint Marie, okay? The abbreviation is the Sioux. The Sioux is in effect a valve, and there are relatively obscure agencies that in part have a control over how open the valve is or isn't, okay? If it's open and water is freely flowing from Lake Superior through the Sioux down to the Straits of Mackinac, where it then goes into the Huron. Don's right, it's essentially a little bit over a year for the water to flush out, but that gets tinkered around with for all sorts of reasons. You had a quick follow-up, and then the woman next to you had a question.
Yeah, quick follow-up. Can you talk a little bit more about the increase in lake effect snow and what that might look like for the region? How, like, that's
what
you will definitely need to be prepared.
Yeah, the studies are insufficient at this time. There are suggestions that we'll likely see an increase in lake effect snow, but just how large an effect is not known because it really depends on how much the ice levels in the lakes change, and that still hasn't been modeled very well. It's something I'm hoping that we're going to be able to try to do in coming months, but that just hasn't really been done yet.
Thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
What is there like a legislative need for addressing invasive species? I know in Chicago there's one thing that gets people stressed about, like mentioning Asian like that is a big deal. Is there, what is being done scientifically, and is there a legislative need that we can fill?
Specifically on the Asian carp issue, there's a series of actions involving the Army Corps of Engineers in which their proposed action steps have recently been finalized, and there's a series of steps that are being taken at the Brandon Road Lock and Dam near Joliet, Illinois. Brandon Road is in effect a pinch point between carp getting up from the Mississippi River system through the Illinois River system and hopefully not into Lake Michigan and the Great Lakes. There are other pathways by which carp can get in. The Brandon Road is viewed by many as being, this is the key, as I said, pinch point. The Army Corps is now moving forward and is beginning to get funding from Congress to implement a series of measures that are an additional electric barrier, some sound waves and other things that are designed to discourage the carp from moving forward. There's sort of a portfolio of steps being taken. It is certainly a series of steps in a positive direction, and we've been supportive of what the Army Corps is doing. We're also concerned that it may not go far enough, and we need to watch very carefully to see how much closer carp are actually getting to Lake Michigan and the Great Lakes, and making sure we do everything we can before it's too late. You simply don't want to wake up one morning where carp have entered the Great Lakes in a significant number and say, why didn't we do everything we could have done
to keep that from happening.
Dana, do you want to add to that one?
Just one more idea. It's with invasive species, it's the organisms we know about, and then there's groups that we can't anticipate. And so thinking collectively about the pathways by which these organisms could make their way into the lake, one could be in ballast water, these are things that I think deserve a little bit more attention.
Any other questions or suggestions? Thank you to the senators who helped facilitate this, Senator Stabenow, Senator Duckworth. Thank you to our partners at Northeast Midwest Institute, and thank you to our three professors who've joined us, and thank you for joining us.